Good evening, guys. We are live. Just give it a few seconds to catch up as always. And there we go. There we go. Good evening, guys. There we go. Good evening, guys. Welcome to Live and on Drugs Series 3, episode 16, I think. Could be wrong. But we are with Donna Brown this evening, and Donna's going to share her life and her experience, strength and hope. Please don't forget to share and get this out there as usual. Donna, thank you for coming on.
Not a problem at all. It's a pleasure and it's an honour. And it's actually a privilege to be able to share my experience of strength and hope as well, because I find people need to hear these things as well and realise that people can recover.
Yeah, I agree. So let's go back to the start of your journey.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, I grew up in a place, East Kilbride. That's in Scotland. I'm the oldest of five. At the beginning, life was okay. I stayed with my gran due to unforeseen circumstances. And living with my gran was totally different from what I went to experience. I was actually good at primary school. I actually stuck in at primary school. I'd done the choir, I'd done brownies, I'd done all that kind of stuff. I'd done all the stuff like kids should do. And I can remember always going out and playing and having fun and things like that, things that children should do. And then at the age of 12, I went back to stay with my mum. And then my mum at that time liked to party, shall we say. She would have a lot of people in the house. You'd wake up and it would be, there'd be people everywhere. And then she met somebody. And then obviously married him. And life became very, very different very quickly. Basically, from the age of 13, there was a lot of physical abuse. There was a lot of sexual abuse that started. And a lot of emotional abuse as well. Now, I can remember, like, the sexual abuse. I can remember the child, the physical abuse. I can remember it all. The emotional abuse was what really hurt me, and sexual abuse, because I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know what trauma was then. And so I started acting out. And at 13, I picked up my first drink. And I'll always remember taking that first drink, because when I took that first drink, I downed the whole bottle. It was a bottle of Mad Dog 2020. I'll never forget it. It was orange. And as soon as I drank that, it was like Donna had arrived. It was like there was like no, because all my self-worth, everything, all of that gone. It was just like I had arrived and I was somebody different. I had confidence. I didn't have that fear in me anymore, that the fear that I had at home, if that makes sense. And it made me feel part of as well. And quite quickly, I liked how that made me feel. And I started doing that every weekend. And because I couldn't handle what was going on at home, I was self-harming as well. And at 14, I was taking speed as well. Now, I was actually selling that with somebody, like faking it, kidding on it, was that so that we could get our own speed, if that makes sense. We were cutting paracetamol up and we were kidding on it with speed and all the rest of it. And quite quickly, I went from the lassie who was so quiet and nice, like to everyone, to being a bully in school as well, because I was full of fear. And I didn't want people to see that. I didn't want people to know what was happening at home. So I acted this person that I wasn't. And I acted this person for nearly most of my life until I actually got clean. But basically, like at 14, I started taking speed. And when I started taking that, I just loved how that made me feel. That took me to another place. And I'm not going to deny it. I loved how that made me feel. I enjoyed taking drugs at first because it just took me out myself. It made me feel numb as well. And quite quickly that progressed for me to taking it every day. And at 15, I actually sold somebody paracetamol, which I hate myself for it, and carried on. It was ecstasy, just so that I could get money to buy more drink and things like that, because I didn't go into school. I dogged school. I would go in and sell like a dinner ticket, sell what I could, bully people, take the money off them, and then I would leave school and go. I never done any of my exams. I didn't want to, because I couldn't concentrate in anything. It was like all the stuff that was going on at home, the abuse and things like that, I couldn't handle, and I didn't know why it was happening. And every time I cried out, no, it still happened, and nobody was listening to me, and I didn't know who to turn to, because I thought, if I tell my mum, she's not going to believe me. And my gran, she was like quite ill at this time, and she had cancer, but she cleared it at that point. And I can always remember just wanting to be back at my gran's, and I used to always run back there. I would never want to go home either, because I knew what would happen as soon as I went home. Because at 15 as well, which I will share, which I don't usually share in my shares, I can remember my first ever boyfriend was in my bedroom, and my mum came in, and my stepdad was already battering me, and my mum joined in. And I was getting flung up the stairs, took down the stairs, ragdolled about everywhere. I managed to run out the back door, and I got dragged by the hair of my head right back up. And it took like the skin clean off me. And he ran out of that house that night. But that night I self-harmed myself quite badly. So my mum actually got me sectioned in Dyke Bar Hospital for a year and a half. And but at this time, now I understand why, because I was probably in a psychosis as well, because I was hearing voices, I was hearing all different things, I was a total wreck. And for a 15-year-old lassie, nobody should go through that. It is so wrong. And that's why I do what I do now, because I've got to be a voice for people to understand it. That you can recover. You don't recover from it, but you can survive from it. Yeah. And when I got sectioned, it was absolutely horrible, because I was in a secure unit and there was 13 other people, and they were going to her stairs or not. There was like this big white board, and like they would have all their names on it. I'll always remember it, and it would have her stairs with a question mark and other names and things like that. And obviously there were older people, and like, basically, I would react out, so I'd start hitting people and things like that, and all I would do was get a jag in the ass and get 5 lorazepam. I'll never forget it, because they absolutely knocked the hell out of me. But do you know what? I absolutely loved that feeling too. I'm not going to lie. It was just like, oh, boom, and then he'd back, and that was me out. I didn't have to think about what was going on in my head. And even at the time when I was in hospital, I still couldn't talk out about what was happening at home, because I didn't want to cause any grief to my mum, because I didn't know how my mum would react. My stepdad, I absolutely hated, and I'm embarrassed and ashamed to actually say this, but actually when my mum came in to visit me one day, I actually took a tin of hairspray and a lighter and lit it and went to set it on fire, and I actually got like a jag in the arse right in front of her, and basically knocked out. And then I spent my 16th birthday in there, and my gran came to see me and my mum, and I didn't want to talk to anyone. I can remember getting this sovereign ring because they were all their age at the time and things like that. And then I can remember speaking to the psychiatrist, and she basically was saying to me like, how do you feel, blah blah blah, and I was actually started talking to her, and I actually got out. But when I got out, I didn't want to stay with my mum, because that was where I was meant to go. I went to stay with my, I went and ran for the hills basically. I went to my cousin's in Polbeth, and I met my first ever boyfriend, who I thought would be my knight in shining armour. He was like, he was the one, like, because he, and it wasn't that. The other thing is, he sold drugs as well. He sold coke, he sold speed, he sold hash, he done all that kind of stuff. And so I'm like, yes. I'm like, oh, yes, party. And every, and when I first met him, I took a lot of speed out my bloody box. And it took me right out myself and took that self, that low self-esteem away, took the self-worth away, took all that kind of stuff away. And it was like dawn, I arrived again. And quite quickly, I moved in with that guy. We moved to Edinburgh. And like, I can remember him like having tinfoil and things like that, and me not understanding because I was only 16 at this time, and he was taking heroin, but I didn't know what heroin was at that time. I didn't have a clue what it was. I was just, I didn't pay attention to it. I was more interested in the speed and the coke because I thought coke was fancy. I thought snobs done that, and I'm like, oh well, do you know what I mean? And we had like, we used to go to the room at the top, we used to sell it there. I used to think it was quite cool to be with a dealer as well. And then when I would, used to, like, at first it was just wee slaps about the head and things like that, that I thought, and that didn't bother me at all. Like, I never thought anything of that. And then when I was 18, just after I had had my first child, before I put her into care, which I was going to, he went and battered me silly. He broke my eye socket. He shattered my eye socket. He broke my jaw. He broke my cheekbone. I had to get my kneecap was like put to the other side of my leg, and round basically with a baseball bat. I had to get moved from the Royal Hospital, the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh, to the Western because I had head injuries. And I was in there for a couple of months, and I kept asking for my daughter like, to be put somewhere safe because I knew she wasn't safe. And basically, when I can remember looking in the mirror, and I didn't recognise myself because I was just totally, my head was swollen, everything. They thought I might have had brain injuries and things like that as well. And when I did get out of hospital, he was taking heroin. And I asked him to give me some because I was in that much pain. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to turn to because at this time, I still didn't know what trauma was. I didn't know what addiction was. I didn't know anything, basically. I was still a young child who shouldn't have been going through anything like that at all. And it's like, basically, he gave me a bit to put in a bit of foil, and he made says to make my own tutor, and I couldn't even make that. That wouldn't have sucked up anything, to be honest, and I fried the arse out of it. And I sat there and I just great. And then he ended up running me 5 lines. And when he ran me the 5 lines, I spewed my absolute ringer. But see the feeling it gave me? It made me feel totally numb. It numbed every voice in my head down. I couldn't hear anything, and I can just remember like trying to like slide down the wall, and that was it. I loved it, and that quite quickly progressed for me to start taking it every day. And then smoking it wasn't enough because obviously we had started dealing it as well, which is something I'm not proud of either, but it's just my truth. And we used to get somebody to come round from round the street that just lived round the corner because I couldn't inject myself. I didn't know how to. And he was trying and he was failing miserably, to be quite honest now when I look back at it. And I would get somebody to come round and say, all right, I'll give you a 0.2 if you give me this and all the rest of it. And he would come round and make up my hits. But Trainspotting had come out then as well. And I'm like this big glamorised film, and I'm thinking, that's make-believe because it's a film. None of that will really happen. And so I was injecting, totally not wanting to accept what was happening. My daughter was obviously born, and basically I got another kicking, and I basically ended up phoning social services myself and phoning my mum, because my mum had left my stepdad at this time, and saying I couldn't take care of my child because I couldn't keep her safe. And so basically, I can remember going into the children's panel and basically having to say, look, I can't keep my child safe. I need somebody else to keep her safe. And I can remember what they said to me, like basically about how much love I must have had for my child to be able to do that. But see, at that time, it totally broke me, because the one person that I brought into the world that I thought I could protect and I could love and treat and do what I needed to do and have like that wee perfect family, I couldn't do it. But I had to keep her safe because I loved her with all my heart. And so she went into care, and it was the best thing I've ever done, because she's living a wonderful life now, and the best it is, I get to see it now. But at that time, I didn't. That totally, absolutely broke me. That was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. But at the same time, I could not leave him, because I did not want to go back to where I was. I also didn't want to leave the drugs. And that's the truth of the matter. I couldn't, because I had never withdrawn either, because I'd always had drugs in front of my face. So I didn't even know what a withdrawal was. I had seen it in Trainspotting, but I thought that was unreal. I didn't think it would happen, if that makes sense. Yeah. And so quite quickly, I was taking hits left, right and centre. I was taking about a quarter a day easily, and just totally numbing myself out, oblivious to everything. The kickings I was getting, they weren't bothering me. I can remember I'm splitting my head wide open and like knocking me black and blue again. But at that point, I didn't care. I just had lost myself, because when I lost my daughter, that nearly killed me, basically. I can remember self-harming again then. And just nothing would take that pain away. And I can remember then my granddad with cancer as well. And if I thought that my daughter had broke me, that broke me in two as well, because she was my rock. She was my everything. She was the one person that protected me in my eyes, and she still did to that day. She was the one that looked after me when I was a young child, and protected me and kept me safe. And it was the only person that I ever felt safe with, was with my gran. So when my gran died, I can just remember phoning my mum, because I had to phone her for a public payphone, because we didn't really talk, because I didn't want to talk to her, because I couldn't forgive her for the things that had happened. And I'm glad to say today that I've managed to let that go, thanks to what the things I'll get into. But sorry, I'm having to breathe here. When my granddad, I'll remember this, I slid down the telephone wall and just broke down. And I can remember my ex-partner saying, what's the matter, what's the matter, what's the matter? Because I was meant to be going out to celebrate something for my birthday. And I was just like, my gran's died. And then I can remember saying to my mum, right, I'll come through. And she was like, there's no point, because the funeral's already happened. She never told me. She knew where I stayed, because obviously she'd been through. She knew that she could get in contact with me, because I had a landline at that time, and I had the mobile. I had the wee burner phones. And she never told me when my gran was passed, like in hospital. I later found out that my auntie was telling me my gran was crying for me and things like that as well. And that's something that really, really hurt me, because I think that I deserve to say goodbye to my gran, regardless of the situation, because no matter what condition I was ever in, even before she passed away, my gran was still always there for me. She never, ever turned her back on me. When my mum chucked me out of my house because my stepdad and my ex were fighting because of his, what my stepdad was like saying about me and my chest and things like that in front of my ex, he went and said about him. So that caused a big ruckus. And then my gran had put me up. But when she died, like, that was me. I was totally broken. And I very quickly progressed into drugs again. And I wasn't just happy with taking heroin then. I was taking coke. I was taking crack. I was smoking green. I was drinking. Because I just didn't want to feel any emotion whatsoever. Because every emotion, if I felt it, I just wanted to die. And no last say in their early 20s you feel like that either. Every last issue about there enjoying their life and doing something with their life. And it was like, and what was I doing? Selling drugs and putting up with domestic violence. But anyway, I'll get into, that's like stuff I don't really talk about because I don't touch on that subject. But I thought it was right to do tonight. So basically that heroin quickly progressed for me. And then I can remember going to get a methadone prescription and they didn't even test my urine. This is the best about it. I can remember putting a bit of water in my face, kidding on, I was sweating and saying, I'm rattling. I didn't even know what a rattle was because I'd never had to experience one then. And they put me on methadone. And I can remember I always stored it in my fridge. And I'll never forget, there's one day that I looked in my fridge and it was just full of methadone. And there was nothing in the freezer. And then it was like, I fell pregnant with my second daughter as well. And I put drugs throughout that pregnancy because I didn't think she would be withdrawn. I didn't know what withdrawals were. I was still young, very stupid. But when she was born, I will never forget her cry because she was withdrawn. And that's when it hit me. Like, oh my God, what the fuck have I done? Sorry for my language. And she had to obviously get like medication to help her and things like that as well because obviously she was withdrawn. She had to go to the neonatal unit. But the best it is, when I was in labour, my ex-partner had people coming in buying heroin and kidding on, they were my brothers, and he was going in and smoking it in the toilet and things like that. But I've got a cheat because seeing my daughter was born after she went to the neonatal unit, the first thing I done was went in the toilet and done the same. And that's something I'm certainly not proud of, but I will admit it. Because I could not handle the guilt, the shame that I caused, because I did not understand that my daughter was withdrawn. I didn't even know what a withdrawal was until my daughter was born. So when my daughter was born, obviously she came back into my, she was sent back to my care. She was allowed to come back to my care, which when I look back now, she should never have been allowed to be in my care. And for 15 years that went on, like, she was dragged through addiction, she was dragged through seeing domestic violence. She's now got trauma as well that I gave her, our dad gave her. She's got adverse childhood experience. She's got adverse childhood experiences, just like myself. And when I sit back and think about it, it's like my mum and things like that. I used to say I'd never let my kids see things like that, and then I let my kids see domestic violence, and then I let them see drug dealing. I would put clothes on my kids. I'd put clothes on my daughter, get her ready for nursery, get her ready for school, make her look the part and things like that. But as soon as she got home, she was sent back out to play so that we could take care of her and so we could do what we were doing. And that went on for 15 years and the domestic violence certainly did not stop. But I did try and leave them. I went into Women's Aid and I lasted 3 days because that's when I started to withdraw. And I could not handle the withdrawals. That was something else. I was like, wow, what's happening to me? I didn't understand. And I'm going, why am I spewing? Why would I get this? And all the rest. I was sweating. I couldn't move. I was in agony. And I'm like, holy fuck, sorry for my language. And then I can remember I went back to my ex-partner because that's where I knew I would get drugs. And I knew that would take that feeling away. And so basically I done that again, and then basically I ended up leaving him after 15 years and I met my son's dad, and but he was taking drugs as well, but he wasn't abusive. He was actually, it was emotional abuse I went through with him. Like, he would like bring me down and all the rest of it, locked me in the house. So I couldn't even get my prescription and things like that. So I was sitting rattling and things like that. And it would be fucking horrible because my daughter would have to witness this. She wouldn't be able to get into school. She wouldn't be able to get in. I'd have to say, right, you need to go out and play. You need to do this. It was horrible. And that was him just going out so he could find his drugs and all the rest of it, because we weren't selling them at that point. And so I left him. Obviously, I had another son, and I don't ever share this really, but my son passed away when he was 3 with meningitis, and that killed me. And still to this day, it's coming up for his anniversary, and I'm fucking, it breaks me, because I always think, why did I not notice the signs? Why did I not notice this? Why did I not notice that? But I didn't know what meningitis was. I didn't know the signs to look out for. I thought he was unwell and things like that. I mean, by the time I took him to hospital, within 24 hours, he was dead. And it's coming up for his anniversary. But anyway, basically, after that, I was just a total mess. I didn't care about myself, didn't look after myself, I didn't care what was happening to me. And then a couple of years later, I met somebody else, because I was always going into relationships as well. I wasn't happy being by myself, because I couldn't live with myself, basically. I needed to have somebody there. It was like codependency, basically. And then I met my youngest daughter's father in 2013. And he was very, very controlling. I was told what to wear, how to wear my hair, what way to have my makeup. I was not allowed out anywhere without him. And to be honest, at first, I didn't really bother about that, because I was like, right, well, maybe he cares about me. Maybe he wants me to look good. Maybe he wants this. Maybe he wants that, because of how low my self-worth was, how low my self-esteem was, and because of how broken I was inside, I wasn't caring. I was just thinking I needed things to fix me, just like I felt like I needed to have my kids to fix me. I thought, if I had a kid, right, that's going to fix me. That's going to make me feel better. Right, if I have a partner, that's going to make me feel better. That's going to fix me. And nothing was going to fix me until, obviously, I started doing what I'd done. And that's not until last year that I'd done that. But basically, I fell pregnant to him quite quickly as well. And after I had my last daughter, I got sterilised. But what I did do was, with my methadone, was come off that. I went on to Subutex and then come off the Subutex, because I had a different blood type from my daughter, and so I had to have blood transfusions every 2 weeks, and she had to be born at 33 weeks and she was premature. But thank God she was born without with any withdrawals. She was my little miracle baby, and she still is to this day. She's a shining example, and I'm so proud of her, and I'm so proud to say she's my daughter. I'm proud to see all my kids and my daughters. But basically, her dad, like, after the controlling and things like that, he would lock me in and wouldn't let me out the house and things like that as well, but he would stay in the house. And then it was more emotional again. And then that's when I wanted to self-harm again. I just didn't want to be here again. I was like, no, I can't do this. And no matter where I went, he always found me as well. And it was like, right, it was like, I always thought, have you got a tracker or something on me? I was like, what the hell? How can you find me just like this? And things like that. And that was just, we try to go with my friends just to try and have a normal conversation, just to try and feel normal. And basically, I ended up leaving him because I've not went into like the women's aid stuff that I did with my ex-partner, because I've jumped from that, Jack. But what I will say is I did go into women's aid with my kids, and I did start like trauma counselling. I got that. That helped me immensely. I started CBT actually before it, because and then done the CBT, done the trauma counselling, and basically then we moved back, because I done all the geographical thinking. If I move here, I do this, I do that, then do you know what I mean? This is going to be better. Not knowing that I was the problem. That was the thing. I did not know that it was me that was the problem at the time. And so when I went into women's aid the second time, I took the help and I'd done what was needed. I'd done the trauma counselling. I got the help that I needed. And I started with my methadone. I think I was on about 50 mil, 60 mil or something like that. And then I moved back to Glasgow, and then COVID hit, and I had met somebody else, and there was a lot of madness, there was a lot of carnage, a lot of psychoses as well. I would wake up and I'd be in hospital not having a clue what the hell had happened. I'd self-harmed, I'd harmed others, I had done this all because I thought they were stealing out my house, and then I'd wake up in the morning and it would be there, and then I would like think people are coming through my door, and I would have stuff stashed behind it ready to go ahead with them. I'd have my curtains closed because I thought people were spying on me. I was a total paranoid wreck, because see, if I thought heroin took me to dark places, crack took me to the very lowest of dark places. That took me to hell, and that's the God's honest truth. That, oh wow, that was something else. I ended up sectioned for a month, and my daughter went to stay with my mum. My middle daughter, by that time, she ended up wanting to get her own place and trying to live her own life, but that's something else, that's not for today. And then basically, when COVID hit, after I had been sectioned, I can remember, like, I wasn't happy in the dose of methadone I was on. I went up to 120. But then when we had to self-isolate and things like that, because I've got a heart condition, I was told to shield and I wasn't allowed out. And that freaked the life out of me. And I can remember phoning my addiction worker and begging her to cut me down my methadone, and she would not do it. But I can remember phoning her and crying, because like I couldn't handle what was going on in my head. And she was like, do you want upped? And I'm like, no, I certainly do not want upped. And then I came off the phone to her, and I was just like, fuck this, I am done. I can't do this anymore. And I cut down from 120 to 60 mil. And I'm not going to lie, I took pregabalin and top it so that I was like trying to ease how I was feeling. But I actually managed to do it. I don't know if it was a mindset, because it was like something changed in me. If that day, I don't know how to describe it. It was just like, I am fucking done. And then I done another geographical, because I left my ex-partner, because obviously he was still in the madness, happy to stay in his prescription, happy to stay in street Valium, not caring that it could kill him or whatever. And basically I moved, I went to Stirling. But as much as I hate the place, it got me clean. When I went there, I started cutting down a mil a day with my methadone. And that actually worked for me, but then I was meant to go into, I think it was Buvidal, but the day that I was meant to go into the tablets, I got rushed into hospital, and my gallbladder was bursting, basically, and that was because of all the toxins, everything that I was using, my gallbladder couldn't take it anymore. And as I was getting my gallbladder out, I got a phone call to tell me that my son's dad and my daughter's dad had passed away, and that obviously funeral arrangements had to be made. Now, that for me totally broke me, because I'm like, how did I tell my daughter this? How did I do this? And then I was getting surgery, and then I was getting told that I had to get other surgery because they weren't sure if they had caused a bit malnutrition in the gut, if they were going to have to cut a bit of my bile off and put it up here. But it was actually gallstones in my bile duct and liver after the operation. So I got that done, and then I can remember having to sit there and listening to the funeral arrangements. And there was three people that kept me going while I was in hospital, and Claire was one of them. And sadly, one of my best mates, Mark, he was one that kept me going as well. And I won't mention another one. And then basically, I fell to my knees and I was just like, God, I can't do this anymore. I was like, basically done. Because I'd been offered the Esprinor and I was trying to tell them I'd be into a participated withdrawal, and they didn't understand what I was talking about. And I was like, I cannot take that. I'm just out of surgery. I've had morphine, I've had fentanyl. I certainly cannot take that. And basically they're like, well, do you want to go back on your methadone prescription? And I'm like, no, I certainly do not. And I can remember when I fell to my knees and praying to God, I was just like, please God, take this away from me. Please help me. And I just felt something had my back, and I felt like this presence, as if I'm going to be all right. Even though my daughter's son passed away, it was like I just knew something was going to be all right. And I don't know if it was with him dying that maybe this is how I am the way I am today, but something had to change. And so I'd done the withdrawal. And I'm not going to lie, it broke my back, to be quite honest. It was fucking hard. But I done it. And then just as I got out of hospital, I found out my best pal had went out and got mad with it and killed himself. And he kept me going in hospital, and it's just been his anniversary there. Just need to breathe, sorry. And it was like all these things were happening, and I'm like, why God? Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, why are they dying? They don't deserve to die, and things like that. It broke me. But at the same time, it was making me stronger, if that makes sense, because I knew I had to do it for them. I had to make this change, and something had to change in me. And then I started, obviously, once I'd done the withdrawal and things like that, I started trying to do it myself. And it just wasn't working because I was crazy clean, shall we say. I was all over the place. I was trying to deal with all these emotions that I had locked out with drugs because I couldn't deal with them as a child, then as a teenager, then as an adult. And then all the emotions that were going on after the drugs. And it was so bloody hard. And I done trauma counselling as well. And then I joined a charity, Wave Trust. And also I learned about adverse childhood experiences. And realised that I had a very high score. And then I worked through what I could work through with them. And when I worked through them, I understood what was going on with me. And so the trauma counselling really worked for me that time. And it was the best thing I'd ever done as well, because when I done that, when I joined Wave as an ambassador, I started getting motions passed for domestic violence and child abuse. Glasgow City Council as well, for getting trauma-informed practices and getting it informed and things like that. There's been quite a lot happening with that. But then I embarked as well on Cocaine Anonymous, and it was the best thing I ever done, because that programme saved my life. I can remember going into a meeting and my eyes down. I couldn't look at anybody. I was totally broken. I was a mess. But see the reception I got from these people, they made me feel part of. They gave me a hug. They made me feel all right. And quite quickly, I was going to meetings. I was hammering the meetings. I took on these suggestions and I done it. And then I got a sponsor. It was the best thing I've ever done. And I went through the 12-step program. And that 12-step program saved my life. It was, and it's no scary, like everyone says, with your step four, step five. I'm not going to lie. I was quite happy to give that away. I was like, have it all. Do you know what I mean? There you go, have it. Because do you know what? That's a load of stuff I need away. And I need God to take that away from me. And I needed somebody else to hear it. And then obviously I got my lovely character defects, which I asked for them to humbly be removed. And I know they're still with me, but I'll work on them daily. And then I got to make the amends. And I got my kids back in my life. And now I'm trusted with my grandkids by myself. I get to see my kids on a regular basis. I've started actually making amends with my mum. Somebody I never ever thought I could do that with. When I first started that programme, I said no, I was not making amends with her. I was not talking to her. I was not doing anything. But I learnt to let things go because I realised she was sick as well and she didn't realise what was going on. And I speak to her now every week. And then I get to find out how my youngest daughter is as well. And I found out like how she had her Holy Communion just as I'd wanted because she was baptised when she was born, obviously, because I'm a Catholic. Sorry if that offends anyone. And now she's a wee altar girl. Do you know what I mean? And like, and my mum actually went to church and things like that to get all that stuff done. And now my mum actually prays and things like that. And it's like, how beautiful can that be? And and they say like a life beyond your wildest dreams, but see my life beyond my wildest dreams is being able to give my kids peace of mind, being able to let them put their head in the pillow at night, knowing that their mum is okay and they're not going to get a chap at the door saying their mum's dead. Letting my kids know that even though they've got trauma, they can work on it because I've worked on it and I can sit here and smile now and be happy and I'm content with my life. And I'm the happiest I've ever been, to be quite honest. And that's thanks to Became Anonymous. It's thanks to learning about trauma. It's thanks to Wave. It's thanks to a lot of people. But life is really good now. And it shows you just how much life can change if you really work on it. And if you want to work on it. Because I went from being such a hopeless case with nothing and just wanting to die, to now wanting to live my life and show people that you can survive this. No matter what you go through, no matter what adversity you have to face, you can face that head on if you get the right mindset, if you get the right help and you take the right help and you take the right guidance, you can be a shining example for others. Because now I'm doing the same and it's like, actually speak to counsellors as friends and things like that now, and it's like how beautiful can that be? And it's like, and now I'm genuinely just so content with life now, Jack. And I don't know where to leave it there.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. And I want to thank you for being so open and honest. I know it's quite difficult doing that in private, never mind on here. And this is, you know, this is your first sort of podcast, and I want to commend you for that. And just the hope that shines through, I can identify with quite a lot, the hopelessness, the pain, the grief, the wanting to die, the not being able to give up for love nor money. I couldn't give up for the kids. I couldn't give up for my ex. I couldn't give up for my friends.
It's a horrible feeling because you love the kids so much and you would do anything for them, but for the love or money, you cannot give up drugs for them at the time. you cannot, and it is the most horriblest feeling in the world, and it absolutely breaks you. It broke me, I know that much.
And you know, the whole thing about speaking with, you know, various services and them trying to up your medication, you know, they're so quick to up it.
Yeah.
You know, you'll ring to try and get it lowered, and then somehow you'll find it's upped. Because they're in a place where they just want to treat the symptoms and not the disease.
Exactly. What I found was there was no, like, even though I had a worker who was giving me methadone, there was no help there to try and cut you down. There was no offer of anything else to substitute it, nothing like that. It was just, if you're feeling down, oh, I'll up it. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, I don't want it up, I want it down. I don't want to be in methadone anymore. I'm done. And it's like, when you know when you're done. It's like when you're falling to your knees and like that, done. And it's like, nah, that's not right. It's like, I think every service should be having a hard look at themselves, to be quite honest, because obviously I've heard about, I've seen people in Bovidol because I never got that chance to go on it, and I'm glad I never got that chance to go on it. I'm glad I got to experience, and I know that might sound weird, to come off the methadone the way I did, because I'll make sure I'll never ever go back. That's for sure, because that nearly killed me, and I know that for a fact, because I had a blood clot in my heart, which went into my lung. I mean, it was horrendous when I was in hospital, I'm not going to lie. It was most terrifying experience in my life, apart from when I had to watch my son die, to be quite honest. It was horrible, because obviously I was having to bury my kid's dad as well. Then it was his funeral and I couldn't go to that, and like that still hurts me inside, because there was nothing I could do, but I was totally powerless then. But now I'm not.
Of course. But what a lot of people don't realise is that when, you know, I've had people that are not part of the programme. I don't go to meetings anymore, but I do live a programme. I do a lot of this. You know, when I last used, I couldn't have faced another cold turkey. I couldn't have faced that, and God, for me, you know, God took that away. He put me to sleep, and it's what I describe as, he did surgery on me, because when I woke up, I haven't used again since. Well, that's by the by. We still have to treat, you know, drugs aren't my problem, there were my solution.
Yep, definitely.
Life was my problem, addiction was my problem, disconnection from God, from family, from people is my problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's so many, I've been through so many services. I had a hard time in dealing with grief. And there's one thing that we've got to remember, that when we say we're powerless, that actually makes us powerful.
Oh, yep.
Which is why we say we're powerless, because that gives us the power that makes us powerful.
Yeah.
And we also have to know that we never really move on from grief.
No.
Because it will always be there, but we do move forward, because we do learn how to deal with it better, and we learn how to manage.
I think I'm 13 months now clean, and it was just obviously my clean date, it was 2 days after it was like my kid's dad's anniversary, and then it was like my best mate's anniversary just there as well, and the grief that I've felt has been heartbreaking, to be quite honest. I've regret, I've acted out, but I've not used a substance. And I've not got that desire to use a substance. That's gone. It's like, they say that mental obsession of drugs will go away. And I do believe that is true. Because there's no desire for me to use. There's no desire for me to pick up. All there is a desire to feel the grief and go through the grief. Because I know it's a process. And I know they're in a better place as well. And they're not in misery anymore. They're not in pain. And that's what I've got to remember.
Yeah, yeah. And you've got to remember that, you know, there are days that are better than others. And, you know, sometimes it's easier to deal with than other days. But you've just got to remember that trauma that we live, you know, we take them on, we take on all these traumas through our lives because that's the sort of people that we are. But the best bit of advice I was ever given was that trauma actually doesn't belong to you. You know, it belongs to someone else. It was someone else who caused it, so it belongs to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me sort of mentally shift my head into recovery mode.
Yeah, I get that, because that's what I was explained as well. It's like, you've got to remember, they've got to live with that now. And it's like, and you've got to move on with your life. And then you get the trauma counselling and you'll know what I'm talking about. And then you get the help with that as well. And then you realise that it wasn't you. That was it was them. And so you learn to let it go as well. Even though it still stays with you. And you know what I'm talking about there. It does stay with you, but you learn how to live with it and you learn how to let it go. And as I say, it's like, I can speak to my mum now. I don't hold any resentment against her at all. I actually love the woman now, and I can't wait to start seeing her again and things like that, because it's like, it's still my mum. And I've got to remember, she was sick as well. And I was sick at one point as well. And it's like, at the end of the day, it's just, she was spiritually unwell. And that's what I've learned. And I was spiritually unwell at one point as well. And I've got to say, I'm not going to lie, when it comes to other people, I've got to remember, they were spiritually unwell, but they're very, very sick. And there's certain amends I will not make for that. Because there's no way that I should have to make amends for that. No child should have to ever go through that. And that's why I always use my voice, and I'll always help anyone who's ever struggling, because I know that it tells you in step 12 to carry the message and help the self-suffering addict, but I will always help somebody that's going through what I've ever went through, because if I can help one person, then I'm happy.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, in recovery, I lost my biological mum to cancer Easter 2017, and then my 2-day-old niece to murder less than 3 months later. And I really struggled with that. And, you know, I'm a Christian. I'm a real churchgoer. I believe in the power of God and healing. But I really felt just so broken. And it was a year before we could go to the funeral up in Yorkshire. I live in rural Norfolk. And one of the ministers at our church kindly took me home. And I remember coming out of the funeral at the crematorium, and you know, seeing it was a pink coffin, and I'd really struggle. I really, really did struggle with hate. And his mum you know, a murderer's mum came up to me and hugged me and said, thank you for coming. And that broke me.
No wonder.
Absolutely broke me. And I was sat in Chris's car, the minister, and I bawled my eyes out. And then I was hit with this, I won't say epiphany, but hit with this sudden calmness that you only really get with pain. It's not the only way I can describe it, is when you're so angry and you're raging and you kick something or you punch something and you hurt yourself and you go from that rage to calm. And that came over me, and Chris said to me, what's going on? And I said, I need to forgive him. And not for forgive what he did. He was murdered by his cellmate, but not forgive what he did. But forgive him for me.
Yeah.
To not let him
affect him.
Affect my heart, because bitterness and resentment and unforgiveness, it's all poison. And it's like, you know, when we get like that with other people, it's like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. It's not going to happen. And we have to look at it for our own mental health.
Yeah,
and we, like you say, we can't do it for anybody else. We can only do it for ourselves. And I commend anybody that has dragged themselves up by the skin of the fingers, because it's so hard to do. It's so hard to do.
And thank God for a God. That's all I can say, is thank God for my higher power, thank God, because if it wasn't for him, I know I wouldn't be where I am now. And it's like, every morning I pray, I meditate, I make sure that I'm in tune with him every day. And I know that every day I say, if anything's annoying me, affect me, I just say, thy will be done, because I know it will.
It's just your pass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Brilliant. Is there anything that you would like to say to anybody watching?
Just anyone that's watching that's ever been where I have been, you just can get through it. Just get the right support and go for it, because you've got nothing to lose. You've got everything to gain. And if I can sit here and say this 13 months clean and not used anything and actually smile and be happy with my life, for once in my life, I'm actually happy. And I'm not that scared to be lassie anymore. I've got self-esteem. I've got self-worth. I've got self-respect. I look after myself. I work a program into my life. And now I volunteer as well with a recovery community. I do training. I do all sorts of stuff. I help people in recovery now. And if I can do that, anyone can do it. It really is worth it, and go for it, because do you know what? It'd be the best thing you could ever do. It really could.
Thank you. Guys, thank you ever so much for tuning in as always. And I shall see you again, hopefully, next week.